Hey, what's up, everyone? Thanks again for joining for another episode of the Ride MTB podcast. Today, we have a really cool episode with a good friend, Richard Lakina from Ninja MTB. For those of you who are not familiar with Ninja, they are a coaching service that offers in-person clinics all around the country, and they serve about 15,000 individual people through clinics each year. It's been really fun getting to know Richard over the last few years. He actually started out as a tech entrepreneur who's had some really high highs and some very low lows. And he was very open in sharing a lot about kind of the entrepreneurial side of running a business in the mountain bike space, creating something that's scalable, and a lot of the trials and tribulations he's been through with the coaching side and things he's learned that could maybe help other coaches improve their craft. So with that being said, I hope you really enjoy this episode. I think it's going to be a fun one that you'll learn a lot from. And before we jump into it, I just want to say a huge thank you to all of our Patreons and our sponsors for making this podcast possible. If you do find yourself enjoying it and you want to help us out, the best thing you could do is just share it with a friend. That helps us grow more than anything. So with that being said, let's jump into the podcast with Richard and hope you enjoy this one. Thank you so much for joining me today, Richard. And before we jump in, I just kind of wanted to say first and foremost how much I appreciate everything you've done with Ninja. During the pandemic, when April and I started doing our mountain bike coaching videos, you know, there was a lot of grumblings that I heard from different coaches and companies that were upset that we were giving out information for free when, you know, they're basically charging for a service. And so I understood that perspective. And when you reached out to me, I was almost a little nervous about what the conversation was going to be like. But you just showed kind of this abundance mindset, which I was really appreciative of. And you saw the videos that we were doing as a bigger funnel that would get people into in-person coaching. Thank you so much for kind of your mentality and perspective on that. And it's been really fun getting to know you and be a part of the Ninja thing. You are a sponsor of ours, but I would still be doing this even if you weren't, because I just really appreciate what you've built.
Yeah, thanks, Kyle. I appreciate that. Yeah, it is good to know that we're on a similar page there. And I'm not sure why instructors were giving you a hard time there. I've always believed that, you know, you've got to give this information out. Like when I started coaching, it wasn't about you know, making money or running a business, really. It was about helping other riders learn what I had spent a lot of time learning myself. And I got a lot of joy out of that. And I feel like that's what I needed to be doing. You know, they say, if you do what you love, you'll never work another day in your life. And that's really what I focused on. And then the business just kind of got built around that premise.
Yeah, that's awesome. And with that being said, can you briefly explain to people kind of what the scope of Ninja is?
Yeah, Ninja does a few things. So we've been in business since around 2010-ish. There wasn't like an official start date. It just kind of evolved to where it is. That's the first time I can remember using the word Ninja. But Ninja does mountain bike skills instruction throughout the U.S. We teach in about 47 states. I think we're in just over 60 cities. We've got 200 plus coaches, certified coaches across the U.S. who teach those classes. Those classes range from fundamentals, half-day clinics, to full two-day camps that include everything from the fundamentals to intermediate to advanced, including drops, jumps, manuals, cornering, climbing, descending, gear changing, brake use, etc. Ninja also manufactures its own mountain bike jump ramps, and we also manufacture mountain bike knee and elbow pads. So I think that's the core of our business.
How did you start this whole journey, I guess, would be the next question is, you know, were you into mountain bikes from a young age? When did you start to know that you wanted to be a coach? Like, how did this whole thing kind of kick off?
Man, that's a big question. I'll try to summarize. I don't really know where to start, I guess.
You can go back as far as you want. I'm really interested in your perspective on things because, you know, we've talked in the past a bit, and I know that you were a tech entrepreneur first before doing this. So maybe you could kind of get into how did you become a tech entrepreneur and also like an avid mountain biker? Was that something you were passionate in from a young age the whole time, or how'd that go?
Yeah. So I'm 50 years old. I was born in 1973. So in 1978, which may seem like a long, long time ago, I got my first dirt bike, which was a 50cc Honda. And I got my dirt bike before I got a bicycle. And I loved that little dirt bike. I just rode the thing constantly. I jumped it, cornered it, tried to wheelie it, like whatever. It was just a part of me. I don't remember how I ended up transitioning to the bicycle, but somehow I ended up with a Schwinn Stingray bike. I don't know if you remember those. Obviously, I'm sure you do, with the banana seat and the.
I've seen pictures of them in museums.
Right on. Yeah, well, I had one and rode one, and man, I got so much joy out of riding that bike because of the curb on the banana seat. It was real easy to get your weight back and wheelie that thing. Yep. So you just rest your butt in the crux of the banana seat and just wheelie it for days. We had a driveway that was about 250 or so feet long, paved, and I would just wheelie up and down this driveway all day long. And I remember one day realizing, like, I wonder if I can wheelie around the end of the driveway, you know, without getting off the bike and go back. Because every time I get to the end and I'd be bummed, because I didn't know how to turn and go back. So it took a lot of practice, but finally started understanding how to manipulate the bike in a wheelie and get it to kind of turn. And then once I got that nailed, I'm like, wow, this is, I mean, that was everything. And then I started putting on shows for my neighbors. I think that's where I first started earning money as a cyclist. I would charge, I think it was 10 cents and maybe 8 or 10 neighbors would show up. And my first shows were simple. It was just watch me wheelie kind of thing. And then it progressed. The neighbors wanted more. So I started jumping. And then eventually it got to the point where my parents shut it down. I was, we had a 3-foot retaining wall that transitioned from grass to the paved driveway. And I would just, as the finale for my show, I would just send it off that thing on my Schwinn bike and just land right on the pavement. And usually turned out okay, but not always. I think the final show, the thing that my parents really shut me down for was I had set a hula hoop on fire. And I was convinced that, well, I'd never been able to do this in practice, that during the show, you know, and I wasn't very old. I think I was, you know, maybe 10 or 11 years old, made a jump out of cinder blocks and plywood like everyone did then. I could somehow jump through the hula hoop on fire. And by the way, the hula hoop was mounted on top of a plastic trash can that was full of water. I don't know. I thought that would make it more exciting. But I jumped, came up short, hit the trash can, and it was full of water, so it didn't fall over. It just stopped me. I crashed in the hula hoop. Hula hoop lands on the ground. It's just melting plastic on the driveway. And I'm just laying there bleeding. That was it. So that's when I officially got shut down. So I guess that's where the love of bike riding kind of started for me.
Were you pretty inspired by Evel Knievel and guys like that back in your youth?
Oh, absolutely. I wanted to be Evel Knievel. I had so many aspirations to just jump things and be ridiculous. And I did jump everything. I mean, nothing like Evel Knievel, but in my little 11-year-old mind, it was pretty substantial and a lot of fun. I kept riding bikes and dirt bikes, kind of both, until I was probably done with high school or so. I guess out of high school, I was a little bit wild. I bought a Yamaha RD350 street bike. I'm sure some people know what that is. But I would just practice wheeling that thing up and down the road all the time. And the police in the town I was in kind of had enough of me. This may be too much for this podcast, but I got stopped by a police officer and he walked around the front of my bike. I was straddling the motorcycle. He leaned over the handlebars, pulled up my visor on my helmet and looked at me and said, "Son, if it's the last thing I do, I'm going to remove the wild hair from your butt cheeks." And that's it. And then they impounded my motorcycle. They gave me a bunch of tickets and I got reckless driving, whatever, and lost my driver's license. It was just the final straw. They finally just had enough. So I didn't have my motorcycle anymore, a driver's license. So I started riding my bike everywhere. And at this point, I guess this was like 1992 or so. And I had a job at a home improvement store, kind of like a Home Depot. It's called Home Quarters Warehouse. And it was an 11-mile ride from where I was living to work. So every day I would ride my bike in the morning, work my shift, and then ride back. And, you know, rain, snow, whatever, night, dark, just riding. And then I started timing myself. And I noticed I just kept getting faster and faster and faster. And it wasn't about competing or racing anyone else. There weren't that many people on mountain bikes then. One day on the way into work, I was traversing through some trails. This was in North Carolina. I noticed someone was behind me, which was quite unusual. And when I got to the end of the trail, that rider rode up beside me and said, "Hey, do you race mountain bikes?" I'm like, "No, why?" And I mean, I'm riding, I'm pretty sure this bike was a Huffy that I had, you know, covered up the Huffy decals on, and I had put on a rack on the back and like a couple cup, like it was not a race bike, but it was a good commuter bike. But he asked me if I raced. I said, "No." I asked him why. And he said, "Well, you're fast. You should come to a race. There's a race this weekend and I'll show you around. Meet me there." So I did. I went to my first race and I did terrible. It was terrible because at that point I didn't know how to bunny hop. And one of the first things out of the chute was this log that was down and I couldn't get over it. I remember pulling the front wheel up, jamming my chainring into it, kind of pedaling over it. Then everyone just rode away from me. I'm like, "Huh." And then I guess that's where I realized my competitive nature in, you know, not just making myself better, but trying to be competitive with others. And then that turned into a racing career that went from then. So I guess that was like age 19 all the way up to age 40, up till 10 years ago.
Would you say that, you know, when you're doing all your little stunt shows and stuff as a kid, you maybe didn't have the skill to be pulling off some of the things that you were trying? Or
I definitely didn't have the skill set. The only skill I really had was, you know, those Schwinn bikes didn't have front brakes and it had a coaster brake on the back, which didn't work real good on my bike anyway. But, you know, the way you stop those bikes effectively, the way I did is you jam your foot into the, you know, in between the wheel and the fork, and then the front wheel kind of stops. And so I learned how to kind of, you know, endo or kind of pivot on the front wheel. So that my skills were that plus wheelie, and everything else was just like delusional optimism. Like I was certain that I could do it, even though I had no training experience or even success. I mean, I'm jumping through a loop on fire. I don't even know if I could do it. I don't even think my bike fit through it. Like it didn't make sense, but in my mind, I could see myself soaring through the flames and everyone clapping. And no, it wasn't that.
That's awesome. So then going into that cross-country career and wanting to kind of start building those skills, is that how you developed your own technique with coaching? Was it just basically trying to figure out your own stuff, or how did that work?
You know what? I did work on my own skills, but for cross-country racing back then wasn't particularly technical. The only real technical thing on that course that I recall is that log right at the beginning. It wasn't till much later. It was probably 10 years later, 8 or 10 years later, I was racing predominantly cross country in Southern California. And a friend of mine who was also a racer, he was racing Cat 2 and I was racing pro at that time. He said, "Hey man, you got to do this Super D thing with me, Super D race." And Super D races were on Saturday and cross country was on Sunday. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do the Super D because I don't want to be worn out from my race on Sunday. These races are important to me. And you know, I'm starting to get some sponsors and making a little bit of money here. I really got to focus on my race. But he just kept pestering me. And finally, I'm like, okay, I'll do the Super D. So I did the Super D and I'm like, I'm going to crush this guy. Like I'm a good rider. This won't even be a thing. And we look at the times and he smoked me. He absolutely smoked me. And I couldn't get my head around how he was so much faster than me. So the race, I did my cross country race, did okay. And then on Monday, I didn't leave the race venue. I set up my tent across the street in the forest and then spent my days rewriting the Super D run that I was the slowest at. And I realized that I was losing most of my time in the corners. And I'm like, okay, there's some secret to this I don't understand. And the first corner was this big kind of middle apex rutted out corner on a pretty steep descent. And it was rutted to the point where I didn't know if I should put both wheels in the rut or the back wheel in the rut or the front wheel in the rut, or no wheels in the rut, or cross over the rut. So I just kept riding it over and over and over and trying every different situation, like, you know, come at it from the inside, come from the outside, pre-turn, cross the rut, whatever. And I finally came up with the fastest way to ride that particular turn. And then I kept doing that on all the corners for the rest of the course. And then I was very analytical and strategic about that. And I wanted to make sure I truly understood so I could apply this to my cross-country racing or to Super D if I kept doing it. So I was sort of building a curriculum unintentionally just for me, and it worked. I continued racing Super D, which eventually became Enduro, I guess. And from that day on, every Enduro or Super D race I entered, I podiumed at. And it was because I had the fitness of a cross-country racer, but now I knew how to corner. And a lot of cross-country racers didn't put that much time into the technical skills. They were focused on power and training and, I mean, you know, as a racer. So that's where I really started learning things. And then from that, I remember being approached by an athlete who was like, "Hey, can you help me with my corners?" And I told her, "I think so. I've got a curriculum that I've put together for me. I've never shared it with anyone, but let me give it some thought, organize my notes, and we'll meet up." And I rode with her a little bit and realized I could help her. And I helped her in very short order. And I started getting even further into understanding cornering. So now pressure control, footwork, where should my foot be when, which foot, you know, where should I be looking, bike body separation, how high on the bike or low on the bike, all of these variables. And slowly came up with this formula for cornering fast and was able to teach it successfully, this one rider. And then she told someone else, and next thing you know, I'm coaching 3 pro enduro riders in Southern California, and they're all having success. I'm like, huh, I think I've got something here. And at this point, you know, at that point I was a full-time mountain bike racer, so you make it, it's hard at my level of racing to make any real income.
So this maybe is kind of jumping the gun a little bit, but this is after you did the whole tech thing, and so now you're a full-time racer, but a lot of it's just for passion, correct?
Yeah, that's a good point, Kyle. I mountain biking and biking, riding bikes has always been a part of my life, but it's kind of come and gone. I've gotten distracted by a few things, but then I always end up right back on my bicycle. So yeah, to backtrack for a second, somewhere along the way, I started a computer consulting company for small and medium-sized businesses. And that did reasonably well. It wasn't huge, but it was big enough. I ended up selling that company to a guy who runs a big venture capital firm. I don't know, you might have heard of Tim Mott. He's the founder of Electronic Arts, and I think he founded Audible.com and some of those. So I got a unique opportunity, you know, to sell to him. So that was a win for me. And and to learn how to scale a business. So, you know, I worked with Tim and his team of managers and directors to build this technology company with them. As a condition of the sale of my company, I needed to work for him for 2 years, which was the best thing that could happen to me. And while I was stuck in an office and traveling from hotel to hotel and going to meetings, not riding my bike, I was learning how to scale a business. So that information, that knowledge, would I'd later use to scale Ninja. So yeah, to answer your question, the work I was doing as a coach was after I had sold the business. That being said, there's one other kind of life event that occurred before I started becoming a coach full-time and a racer full-time. After I sold the technology company, I decided to get involved in real estate. And that was great, dude. Everything I touched turned to gold. I couldn't mess up. Everything I bought appreciated and cash flowed. It was great. Until 2008. 2008, you know, the whole real estate market fell apart. I was over leveraged. I couldn't fix it. There was no way out. And everything imploded around me in a very terrible, tragic kind of way. And it was a really, really difficult time in my life. And as everything I had melted away, I remember thinking, what am I going to do now? And then I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, I'm going to simplify my life. When you have a big reset like that, when you lose everything, you've got an opportunity to think of what's important to you and what's not. And for me, the thing that kept coming to mind was riding my bike. I just want to ride my bike. That's what I'm good at. I think I can make a living at it. If I can reduce my living costs, which are now next to nothing, because I've essentially lost my house, my cars, my life, everything's set to zero. So I bought a little, I think, 12-foot lawnmower trailer, like an enclosed cargo trailer. And I put a mattress in there and a dog bowl and a water bowl and a little cooler. And me and my dog just went out on the road and started getting back in shape for racing. And then coaching was how I funded my, you know, the few bills I had living on the road.
Yeah. Can we touch a little bit just on that whole experience of kind of the come up and then the crash of 08 and all that stuff? Was it, did you grow up with much money? And then was it weird coming into money and then having money and losing it all? Did that change your perspective on life in any way?
Yeah. As a kid, we weren't wealthy by any means. My dad was a school teacher and my mom didn't work. And we lived in a modest house in a kind of a rural neighborhood in Connecticut. And it was fine. And then I always knew I was going to be successful. At least I thought I was. You know, this is another step backwards in the story. Hopefully this all pieces together okay. But my living situation as a kid wasn't good. It wasn't healthy. My father was an alcoholic and abusive. And the bicycle was truly the thing that allowed me to escape from that. When things were bad inside or if he was drinking or yelling, I'd just go get on my bicycle and ride. That was my escape. That was my freedom from all that. So I guess at about age 15 or so, or maybe it was 14 or 15, I reached my final straw with my living situation, got in a big physical fight with my dad, and I left home. And I was essentially, I think, a 15-year-old homeless kid, and I was hitchhiking around the country and just trying to figure things out. Ended up back in North Carolina. A girlfriend that I had, or an ex-girlfriend, a girl that I had met prior, her family agreed to let me live on their property and their farm in exchange for me working on the farm. So the deal was I took care of the horse, I took care of the dogs, I mowed the grass, I, you know, plowed the fields, whatever they needed, I dug holes, like I did it. And then they fed me and they gave me a place to sleep. And that was a good deal. But the girl who I was staying with after a year and a half was going to college. She was going to UNC at Chapel Hill. And I'm like, well, I don't want to be on this farm by myself. I enjoyed her company and wanted to stay with her. So I, when she went to school to live in a dorm, I went to UNC at North Carolina at Chapel Hill with her. But I didn't have, you know, enough money to afford an apartment or a place to live. So I just pitched my tent in the woods outside of campus and I lived there. And while she was at class during the day, I would spend my days in the business library. And over a course of 2 years, I just read business books constantly. I just got addicted to them and couldn't stop. And ended up writing a business plan in the library for the computer company that ended up growing and selling to Tim's group. But I knew, you know, when you read that many success stories, that I just knew that I would be successful and I would be wealthy someday. I wasn't entirely sure how, but I just had confidence that I would. So when the computer company started growing, it was nice, dude. I thought that is what happiness was. I thought having money and wealth made you happy, but it truly, truly didn't. I was 100% miserable. You know, I had the big house on the cliff overlooking the ocean, the big pool, all the great stuff that everybody thinks they want. And it was the loneliest, most terrible place I think I've ever been. And I wanted more than anything, and that's probably why everything came crumbling down. I wanted to reset. I wanted to get out of that. So I truly wasn't happy when I was in that situation. I was happy again when I was living. So I eventually upgraded my little cargo trailer to a 19-foot travel trailer, a proper camper. And I was happiest when I had that thing parked on a hill someplace, a national forest, kind of near a race course and just away from everyone and just focusing on me and my riding. Money wasn't important. And yeah, that was it. I don't know if that generally answers your question.
Yeah, no, it's super interesting because I think that, I don't know, at least for me growing up in that similar situation of not having the most stable childhood, then you kind of think, okay, well, one day if I can create stability financially and I can achieve this goal, then my life's going to be better. And then when you get to that place, you're still the same kid and you still have all this other stuff going on internally. You just have more money. Yeah. So there's a saying, I think it says, money won't buy you happiness, but it'll just make you more of who you are. And so it's like, if you're a good person, you're trying to do good things, it'll make you do more of that. And if you're struggling, you have internal conflict, it'll make you do more of that. I guess it's just interesting to hear your perspective because having that reset, having the bike be kind of the through line throughout this whole entire story of this is your escape, this is what makes you happy. And then having that reset and then getting back into the coaching thing and now becoming a part of the mountain bike industry in a way that is scalable and you're an entrepreneur and you're doing well with this and it's growing. But it seems meeting you and spending time with Hannah, I can tell that money is not what motivates you. So can you maybe speak to that a little bit more about finding motivation outside of money after kind of having it and realizing that doesn't bring you fulfillment? What does?
Yeah, I remember. So I was doing, as I got older, closer to 40, I started doing endurance racing instead of cross country. It was a little easier on my body. I know that may seem counterintuitive, but riding 100 miles at full throttle was easier than riding 18 miles at full throttle because it's a different kind of full throttle and pacing. So I started doing bigger races. I did Leadville a few times, just all the big known races. And then word started getting around that I was doing some coaching. I started writing training plans for people doing those big races. And then at one particular Leadville race, I don't recall which one or what year it was, but I was coaching an athlete who he owned a business and had a new family and really wanted to race Leadville. And he had called and said, "Hey, will you coach me on this event to get me ready? The event's a year from now." And I'm like, "Sure, I'd be interested in doing that. I can write you a training plan. We can work together for a year and get you ready for the race." I'm like, "What's your goal? Are you looking for a gold buckle or sub? You know, what's your goal?" He said, "Dude, I just want to finish." I'm like, "Okay, I got you. Let's do this." So, you know, as often happens to entrepreneurs or business owners, he things got busy in his life. He kind of wasn't doing the training. He was missing workouts, et cetera. And he honestly wasn't ready for the race. It was like I wasn't sure if he's going to be able to finish it. I hoped he would. I gave him every tip, every pointer I could for the fitness, but he just wasn't quite there. And I was racing that race with him. And as a pro rider, they put you in the gold corral. So you start first in Leadville. And he was somewhere in the back of the hundreds and hundreds of people behind me. And I take off on this race. I had done it many times. I know what a fast time is. I know what I can do. But I realized right then, like, I've got nothing to prove here to myself, to anybody else, to my sponsors. I'm going to hold up and I'm going to wait for this rider. So I pulled over to aid station. I waited 15 or 20 minutes. He came through and he looked terrible. His head was down and he hadn't been eating or drinking or anything. I'm like, "Dude," he said, "what are you doing here? Why aren't you racing?" And I'm like, "I'm here for you, man. We're going to finish this race." So I got him water, got him hydrated, and he just kind of came back to life. And I'm like, "I'm going to set a pace. Just talk to me and we're just going to ride this thing out together." And we did. And we rode that race and he kept eating and drinking. We'd bring the pace up a little bit or down, whatever made sense for his fitness level. And I remember we got to the finish that race, we're going up that last climb. And I looked and I saw his wife standing there at the finish line waiting for him. And this was, I mean, we were on course for a long time, like hours longer than I would expect to be, but we were finishing. And I had my hand on his back and I was not pushing him, just, you know, letting him know I'm there with him. And I saw his wife and I just fell back and I let him go across the finish line. And as I rolled up, I looked up, his wife was crying, he was crying. And then I rolled over to him and said, "Congrats." And he gave me a big hug. And I'm like, it was the best feeling. It's the most joy I'd ever felt as a coach and as a cyclist. And I realized that's my calling. That's what I got to do. I've got to coach people, train people, work with people. I get more joy out of somebody hitting a jump for the first time or riding a manual for the first time, hitting a corner for the first time than I do, you know, accomplishing goals as a rider. So I think that's where where I realized the joy. And then the more I give, the better I feel about it. In every regard. And that's really what Ninja is based on. Ninja is not about money. It's about helping riders become better riders. And it just so happens because we believe in that and we're passionate about that and focused on that, everything we do revolves around that. We ended up with a good product and a considerable company.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think one thing that spoke to that was talking to the coaches, and we did a little coaching retreat at your house. And I thought it was really interesting. You're like, hey, if you're a ninja coach, but you still want to do your own stuff on the side, like, we'll support you doing that. And we want you to make money. We want you to have this be financially stable for you. And like, yep. We don't want to transaction every single thing. It's like, we're here for yep. you when you want to do a ninja coaching clinic. If you're not doing a ninja clinic, you can do your own thing. And I thought that was really cool, because it wasn't like you're trying to be all controlling and take everything. So I guess one thing I wanted to ask you is, within coaching, I guess learning how to scale a business, the problem with in-person coaching is you can only realistically coach, you know, 10 people, let's say 10 people, just for example, at a time, and have it be a good product. So with you, is that when you started saying, okay, I want to do more of this, but I need to start hiring other people to help me be coaches? And how do you find coaches that would help and that you can trust?
Man, I got lucky. When I first started actually running skills clinics, like as a clinic, advertising them and having people show up, I felt a lot of that same joy that I described at that Leadville race. Demand started to kind of increase, and I was getting calls from mountain bike organizations and clubs and groups and race teams and individuals all over the country. And I'm like, dang, I can't be everywhere at once. And I was running myself ragged, just pulling this trailer all over the country, trying to, you know, grab these opportunities. So I realized quickly I need to hire someone to help me. And at the time, the BICP, if classes were being offered in the US, I wasn't aware of them. I think they were just being offered in Canada at the time. But I think IMBA got involved and either bought or partnered or something with BICP to offer the program to potential coaches in the US. So there was no pool of coaches to call or to solicit or to come work with us. So I wrote this curriculum, and I just called friends who I knew were really good writers. I'm like, here's the thing I'm teaching. Here's the curriculum I wrote. I need help. Would you be interested in teaching a class with me? So I brought on one friend who was a former pro downhill racer from New Zealand, and he just ripped on the bike. He just had a great personality, very personable. People loved him. He could explain things well. He could demo things well. And we made some tweaks to the curriculum to make sure we're all on the same page. And then the business doubled instantly as soon as he was teaching. And then there was need for women's only clinics. I'm like, all right, I can teach those, but I think they'd be more impactful if I had a female instructor teach. So another friend of mine, Chris Gross, she was a Canadian pro mountain bike rider, really great athlete, great human. I approached her and I said, hey, would you be interested in teaching women's classes and maybe teaching, assisting me on some co-ed stuff? And she said, yes. And so she started running the women's classes. So now the company is three times as big. So then I just kept refining the curriculum. And about this time, BICP became a thing in the US, and now coaches were being minted everywhere. And while many people were just signing up for the program, I think, to better themselves as riders, there were many that wanted to make a living out of it, or, you know, a side hustle or some additional income from it. So I started contacting them and going from there. Go ahead.
Could you explain what the BICP is?
Yeah, BICP, I should know what the acronym is, but it's a instructor certification program for mountain bike instructors. It teaches you not only how to teach the specific skills, but also how to run a clinic or a camp. And that was the most important component of that. So when they started making instructors, then we started hiring them. And about that time, PMBIA, which is Professional Mountain Bike, I don't know acronyms, but the other big body for certifying instructors started becoming more prevalent in the US. And all of a sudden, I've got instructors everywhere who want to work, and I'm trying to scale. So the timing was perfect. So I just kept calling and interviewing. And if I found someone who sounded interesting on the phone, I'd say, okay, for example, if they were in New Mexico, I'm like, meet me at this trail. I'll be in New Mexico in 2 weeks. Let's go ride. And I'd go ride with them. We'd hit a jump line. We'd hit some corners. We'd ride some drops. I'd ask them to show me a manual to bunny hop. If they could do all of that, and if they understood the curriculum, what they were doing, then they'd start as an assistant to me. I'd have them teach with me. And then once they understood the curriculum, then they'd lead. And we just kept doing that over and over and over. And there were definitely some pitfalls in that. And then, you know, the telephone game where if I tell an instructor something like, here's how we teach jumps, and then they tell another instructor, and then they tell another instructor, by the time it gets back to me, we're teaching jumps a whole different way than I intended. So we had to put in some ways to measure people's knowledge and make sure that they had tools to truly learn and understand the curriculum. So we built out an instructor portal that we give all the instructors free access to, that has in detail how to teach everything we teach. And that went a long way for cleaning up our consistency and making sure we're offering good products.
Yeah. With that being said, what is the hardest skill for you to teach the coaches? And then what is the hardest skill for the coaches to teach the students?
That's tough, man, because the instructors are from all different levels and, you know, experiences and that sort of thing. I think the thing that instructors struggled most with was cornering, which was shocking to me because that's the thing I spent the most time with. Like, I understood cornering. Like, you couldn't dispute my corner. Like, this is the fast way here in a corner. If you can get around it faster, show me. And so I really, really had to take time and be introspective and think about how do I write this in a manner that they really get it. And then I ended up, the thing that really helped us with that cornering was we started running the retreats, like the one you came to at my place in Chiloquin, and showing them and drawing diagrams in the dirt and saying, here's how we corner. Here's what footwork is. Here's how pressure control works. Bike separation, et cetera. So I think that was the hardest thing, but we got a good handle on that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I was thinking it might be either cornering or jumping, depending on, you know, jumping. There's a lot of, controversy around the different techniques. I think the three main ones that I always hear controversy around are drops, cornering, and jumping. And cornering's kind of broken up into two different segments in my mind, which is berms and flat corners. Can you speak a little bit about that, maybe, like how those are broken down, and how do you know that the coaches are teaching the curriculum you want? And do you have like feedback forms that they have to fill out or that the students can fill out, or how does that work?
That's a good question, Kyle. I decided to torture myself early on when I started teaching classes for Ninja. And what I did was I asked every single participant, everyone I coached with or did a class with, et cetera, like, please critique the event. Please critique our interaction. And don't hold back. Like, I really, really want to know what I can do better. And they did. And they gave me feedback. Man, it was hard to read in the beginning. It was like, you know, not enough practice time, too much talking, not enough writing, not enough whatever. It was just these things. I'm like, Jesus, I'm putting my heart into making this amazing. I'm getting ripped apart. But then I don't know what clicked for me, but I realized one day, like, this is constructive criticism. This isn't what I'm terrible at. This is what I can improve on. Mm-hmm. And I really need to get past the personal part of this or whatever I'm feeling and understand it. And when I did that, everything changed. And I started getting better. Any feedback I got, I'm like, okay, why did that happen? What can I do different? I did that. And then as the company grew, I continued collecting that information. So we receive, you know, thousands of pieces of feedback every year, and we're compiling them into this enormous spreadsheet. And before our first biggest Ninja retreat, I think we had 40 or 50 instructors come out for that. I was kind of going over my notes on what I want to talk about for the weekend. And I realized I need to identify what these things are. And I think there are several things in common that keep reoccurring here. I need to figure out what that is and get this information to them so that, you know, the night everyone's arriving at this event, Becky, who does our logistics, and I sat in our shipping container, which was the Ninja office at the time. And we went through this giant spreadsheet and we identified 18 reoccurring things that were going wrong in classes. So we quickly identified those things and then figured out, you know, what they are, how to fix them if they're occurring during your class, and better, how to prevent them. So we came up with this document called the 18 things, and it's gold. As soon as we understood the 18 things and shared that information, our quality went way up.
Could you share a couple, like just three or four of those things? You don't have to give away the whole golden list, but...
Yeah, no, you can have the whole list. None of these will be a surprise, but if you're not thinking about them, it's easy for these things to go wrong. Like, one particular thing is a reoccurring thing was too much talking, not enough riding. Another one was too much time queuing, standing in lines, waiting to demo the skill. Another one might be didn't start on time. No, not enough individual feedback, things like that. So there are little things you can do. Like, for not enough individual feedback, when I'm teaching a class, I make sure to establish rapport with every participant in that class. The first thing I do, and I think this is one of the most important things, I learn everybody's name. I learn it. I made it like my secret power to be able to meet 20 people or 10 people, whatever it is, hear their name once, and then have their name for the rest of the class. And that was big because now they feel like you've got a personal connection with them. And when you give them feedback, it feels more genuine because you started it with their name. So there's that. And then spending a good solid minute or two in each class, doesn't take much to give them feedback. Like, hey, I love what you're doing there, but you're really rigid on the bike. Try to relax before you, whatever the thing is. For the queuing thing, the mistake I was making was my practice areas were too small. For example, if we're working on a jump, I would have them, you know, finish the jump and then ride right back to the, you know, the start of the jump. By expanding my practice area, like, hey, go out around that tree and come back, we eliminated the queuing and they kept riding. They get a little more time to think about what they did or what they want to do different. So Yeah, it was those kind of things. Nothing particularly terrible. But when you get those things ironed out, it really makes a big difference in the class.
That's really cool. Thank you for sharing that. And could you maybe say, like, what's been your biggest challenge from an operations standpoint of, you know, not just the actual on the ground coaching, but from an operations standpoint of bringing all these people together? What has been the biggest challenge? And did you foresee that being a challenge, or was it kind of a surprise?
Man, there's been a lot of challenges. One of the biggest challenges was finding help, because, you know, we permit all of our events. Every event needs travel and accommodations, airfare, whatever worked out, or camping or Airbnbs. And that got really rowdy really fast. So like now on some weekends, we might be teaching in 14 different cities all on a Saturday. And that means there's two instructors per class. And I think there's four or five classes in a typical weekend. So there's lots of instructors have to be taken care of. The permits have to be taken care of. We have to coordinate with park rangers or park staff to make sure we're where we should be and we're not impeding the flow from hikers or anyone else who might be there. Make sure we're not monopolizing parking lots. Like that whole logistics piece just became this monster. So finding someone to help me with that was important. In the beginning, I was trying to do it, and then Hannah helped me with it for a while. But we got real lucky. You know, I think you met Becky Steele at the at the retreat. Man, she came in. She's a school teacher prior and just had great organization skills, was great communication skills, very well connected, could think big, wasn't like focused on one particular area. And she fixed all of that. And that was probably one of the biggest challenges. And she still runs that part of the business for us now. She's got a couple of helpers because we're considerably bigger now. But yeah, I think that was the biggest challenge on trying to grow this.
That's cool. Yeah, her and Jeremiah are awesome.
That's right. You know them. Yeah.
How many clinics do you give in a year, or how many clinics have you given in total? Do you have like a rough idea?
I mean, thousands. I think we do close to 2,000 a year, individual clinics you can sign up for, and somewhere between around 15,000 riders per year. And we've been doing this since 2010, and it's been scaling. It's been growing every year since we've started, and it's continuing to grow this year.
What was it like going through the pandemic, and did you guys experience a lot of growth during that whole bike boom?
Well, that's a good question too. You're finding all the fun points here. Yeah. So when that happened, when the pandemic sort of happened and everyone was quarantined and couldn't go anywhere, we had pre-sold lots of clinic spaces for that year. And that's the way we do. You sign up in advance and then you attend, right? And with all the uncertainty, people didn't know if they're going to be able to attend. Like, they didn't know if they could ever leave their house again or what the situation was. So all of a sudden, our phones, email, live chat, everything's blowing up with people wanting to cancel their events or get refunds or whatever. And I'm like, it was absolutely going to put us out of business. We didn't have a single sale for the month everyone started in lockdown. And we had almost $250,000 in prepaid, you know, spots for clinics and camps. And between us and this podcast, we didn't have $250,000 in the bank to refund all that. So I'm like, all right, we're in trouble. I guess this is how it ends. I don't know. I'll go back to racing. And I'm just like, okay, just figure this out and come up with something. So I came up with what I call the SOAP plan, which is an acronym for Save Our Ass Plan. And essentially it was like, the first thing we got to do is stop people from asking for refunds and just ask for a little more time to let things stabilize. Because in my mind, I'm like, there's no way that this pandemic is going to stop people from going outside. Like, we may have to, you know, space ourselves out 10 feet, but I can yell in a 10-foot circle and still get the curriculum out. We can avoid touching each other or breathing on each other and still do this. So I thought it's likely that we're going to be okay. We just got to get through this. So first thing was a personal email to everyone who had signed up for an event. And I'm like, hey, my name's Richard. I'm the founder of Ninja. This is really hitting us hard. We're trying to get things stabilized. We think we'll be teaching again later this year. We hope that you can just give us a couple months to figure out where we're at. And man, mountain bikers are cool, because I'd say 95% of them wrote back and said, hey, thanks for letting us know what's going on. We'll hold out and see what happens. And that was amazing. Then the next thing was, you know, so now we're not in a situation where we're having to refund all this. But the next thing is, we've got bills to pay. Like, there's still, you know, things going on that have to be taken care of. So I'm like, I've got to get people to sign up now. And right about that time, a Southwest Airlines ad popped up on my Facebook. And the ad said something like, you know, book your flight, you know, full refund if you can't go for any reason, flight gets canceled, COVID lockdown, you get sick, whatever. And I'm like, that's it. That's what we're going to do. So we started advertising, you know, 100% credit if you can't attend the event or whatever, refunds, just please sign up. And they did. And then that next month, when all of a sudden people understood that they could go outside and we could start running events again, things boomed for us. absolutely boom, like they did for a lot, the majority of the bike industry. And they never let up. They never let up. We never went backwards from COVID. Our clinic signups doubled, almost tripled that next month. It was unbelievable. So yeah, so we temporarily went out of business for a second, and then we came back stronger than we ever had. So the pandemic was a good thing for us in the end.
With that being said, was that also a catalyst for you to kind of start doing more of the ramps and the, you know, hard goods like knee pads and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, I had secretly been working on knee and elbow pads for, you know, 15 or 20 years. As a racer, as a cross-country racer, I would always wear very lightweight knee pads. And especially if I was racing Super D or Enduro, in that case, I'd wear elbow pads because my whole livelihood at that point in my life was dependent on my ability to ride a bike, and a bruised up elbow or a dinged up knee or something could take me off. And now I can't race, I can't coach, I can't teach, whatever. As a racer, I hated my pads, and I tried everything. I tried every major brand out there, and some pads gave me blisters, some fell down, some were sweaty, some you couldn't wash, some the stitching came out. It was just one nightmare after another. So I just kind of kept mental note of what I would do if I ever made my own knee and elbow pads. When things were picking up and Ninja was doing well all of a sudden, better than I had expected, I now had some cash to invest in a little bit of R&D and some materials. So we started ordering different fabrics and exploring different stitchings and working on pad insert certifications and tag designs and bags and just all the stuff. And then the product came together. Our first iteration looked great, worked great, except there was an issue with the stitching. So we identified that and very quickly fixed the stitching on the future ones. And so I think that allowed me to get into the pads, and those are doing great. And then the ramps, man, that kind of happened in a weird way also. When we were teaching our jumping classes prior, we were using these little injection mold ramps. They were about maybe 3 feet long and 2 feet wide. And they were great little ramps in that the radius was small enough that it had a good kick, even for a short ramp. And it was not too big, so it was safe for training. And I could very quickly teach 10 people how to do a 4 to 5 foot gap jump. And they were blown away because most people are scared of gaps, I guess. But then those ramps kept breaking and we just would buy more. We just decided these are disposable, they're consumable. Every time they break, we'll get more. Until one day we went to place orders for ramps. And by the way, I was using the ramps. This is right when the company was scaled quite a bit, I guess, at that point. And all the instructors were using these ramps. And now they're not available anymore. The company that started manufacturing stopped. And I called them and pleaded with them. I'm like, hey, I'll order 1,000 of these things. I just need these ramps. I think my customers will buy them. I want them. And we started some negotiations. I said, sorry, we can't make them for you anymore. We're having some changes to the company. We're just done. I'm like, okay, no problem. Can I buy the mold? Can I just buy the injection mold from you and I'll make them myself? We went back and forth on that. And finally, they just kind of ghosted me. And I just stayed persistent, finally got in touch with someone. And they said, yeah, there's been a death in the organization or something and everything's stuck in an estate and it's a mess and we can't do anything with it. I'm like, okay. So then we immediately figured out how to reinforce all the ramps that were breaking around the country. So we came up with this metal kind of skeleton structure that we attached the plastic to, and that worked, but it made the ramps really heavy. So I was looking for another ramp solution. And that's when I came across MTB Hopper, and they were manufacturing ramps in Eastern Europe. And we called and said, hey, we'd like to try your ramps. So they sent us a couple, we tested them, they worked. And then I thought, well, maybe customers will buy these. So we ordered 40 ramps from them just as a test. And we sent an email out to our customers and said, hey, we've got these cool jump ramps. If you're interested, here's the price. You can buy them on our website. They sold instantly. I mean, instant. It was unbelievable. So I called Hopper back and I said, guys, how about this? Would you be willing to do a white label agreement with us? So they manufactured ramps with our branding on them. So they made Ninja ramps for us. And at first, you know, we ordered a 20-foot container full of them, and that lasted a little while. Then we started ordering 40-foot containers. And then we started ordering, you know, multiple 40-foot containers of these ramps, like thousands of ramps coming over. And it just, I don't know what kind of happened, but I think due to COVID, it kept getting more and more expensive to import these things from Europe. There weren't issues with the rail system in the U.S. The containers would come to the East Coast, get put on a train and come to us. And then things were getting stuck at docks and there were shortage of dock workers. It was just one nightmare after another. So we suffered through that for a year and a half or so, or almost 2 years. And that's when I decided, you know, I think I can make ramps better than this, and we can make them ourselves. And that was kind of what steered us to start manufacturing our own ramps. And today we make all of our own ramps. They're not white labeled anymore. We have a manufacturing facility in Klamath Falls, Oregon. We make a ton of ramps and we love doing it. So yeah, I think the pandemic allowed us, you know, the cash flow to explore some of these things that kind of made sense for us. So a lot of things really just fell in place at the right time.
That's cool. Yeah, one of the things I keep kind of hearing when you speak and you tell your life story is just this constant drive and ability to problem solve. And, you know, just always kind of figuring out, okay, what's next? What's next? What's next? How do we keep doing this? Where do you think you developed that? And was that a skill that you learned reading all those business books? Or is that something that's kind of innately in you?
I've always been a problem solver or a troubleshooter. I guess it's innate. Yeah, I'm sure some of it came from the business books too. I don't know where that came from, but if there's something broken, I always want to fix it.
Does that drive Hannah crazy ever?
I was about to say, yeah. Turns out there's some things that don't need to be fixed, as I'm learning, and lots that do.
With that being said, like, what advice can you give, or what do you think is the most common thing people struggle with when it comes to building a business?
Yeah, that's a tough one. Like, I love and have a lot of respect for entrepreneurs. I'll give you a quick story, then I'll answer that question. For a brief moment in time, I decided to enroll in a community college and to study business and entrepreneurship. I'd already, you know, self-studied in the library at UNC, but I thought maybe there's something I'm missing. And I had kind of, you know, I wrote my business plan, but hadn't started a business yet. I remember attending this class in entrepreneurship, first day of class. I don't remember what I was doing, but I was exhausted. And I showed up for class. I'm trying to keep my eyes open and my head up. And there's this giant blackboard across the front of this room. And the instructor walks in and he grabs a piece of chalk. And he says to the class, can anyone in the class tell me what the definition of entrepreneur is? And people are like, people who start a business or run a business or that sort of thing. And he, as people are giving these answers, he starts writing in the board in these giant letters, risk taker, risk taker. And man, I didn't attend another day of that class. I left the class and that was it. But I realized right then that that's what it is. I think my advice for an entrepreneur is if you have something that you're passionate about, something that you believe in, something you want to do, something that truly resonates with who you are. Like if you're trying to do this for the money, I don't know, it might work, but that's never really worked for me. If you're doing it because you believe in it, just do it. Take the risk and go. There are other things I could have done. I could have got a job working for a computer company or whatever, but I followed my passion and my dreams and got me, you know, got me here. And if it doesn't work, well, at least you tried, you know? I mean, I tell you, like, it hasn't all been success for me. There've been some pretty terrible downs and some really, really big ups. And this is, you know, my second sort of substantial business. And I'm working real hard to make good, smart choices because I need this to continue going forward. I don't want to get caught up in things that aren't important. I really want to make sure that we're focused, like I said, on delivering good products.
What's the biggest mistake you have made and what did you learn from that moving forward?
Biggest mistake with the Ninja, I would say, is I have this thing I keep doing, which is eventually going to be bad, but it hasn't hurt me yet. I have trouble saying no to things. So if somebody has this great idea or this great whatever, I always look into it. And I feel like in a couple of situations, I went down paths that could have derailed my focus. And thankfully, I stopped myself and got back on track. So I can't think of any significant big mistakes I made, but there've been lots of little things. But when something goes wrong, we just very quickly correct and move forward. I tell my team that one of the biggest characteristics we need to keep in mind is being nimble. I'm always in a position where we can change. So someone will come to me from the team and say, hey, last week you told us to do it this way, now we're doing it this way. And I'm like, yeah, that's right, nimble. So we changed because of this. And I'll explain it and then I'm like, okay, let's go. So recognizing when you've made a bad decision, you're going the wrong path and fixing it. But I can't think of anything super specific. I've managed to keep things okay so far.
Would you want to work for yourself if you had to?
Oof, man, that's a tough one. If I want to work for me, I don't know. Probably not. You know, I think I'm okay, but I'm just thinking of me. Honestly, from an employee standpoint, I'm just a lousy employee. I tend to procrastinate. I always get everything done, but at the last minute, I'm a little bit lazy, but lazy translates to me to efficiency. Like I won't just do something for the sake of doing something. I need to do it because there's a purpose or an end or something that's going to move us forward towards our goal. So I don't know.
I think that's a pretty common thread that a lot of people, like entrepreneurs or, you know, people in your space have in common, I think, because it's almost like that sense of procrastination or laziness, it almost breeds efficiency and it kind of also breeds risk taking because you just are coming in hot at the last second, like skidding into the finish line.
Dude, let me give you a quick coming in hot story since I've got you. I know you met Lawrence with Garage Bunny.
Yeah.
So on a Friday afternoon, I get a message. I'm at home and I get a message from our customer service girl, Rachel. Mm-hmm. And Rachel says, "Hey, there's this guy in New Zealand who's got this product and he wants to talk to you about making it." And I'm like, "Ugh." And all I can hear is like Hannah's voice in the back of my head. No new shit, no new shit. Focus, you know, don't take on any new projects right now. And I'm like, all right, I click the email and I look at it and it's this video of this guy in the garage, like doing bunny hops on a machine. And this machine is holding his bike laterally and he's doing bunny hops. And I've never seen a bunny hop trainer and I'm blown away by this thing. So I call him on Saturday. I get his phone number and it turns out he's a British guy living in Auckland, New Zealand, who's a civil engineer who's invented this really cool thing called the garage bunny hop trainer. And I call him, I said, "Hey man, I've been staring at this for a while. I haven't slept much last night. I think you got something cool here and I think I can make it for you. Can you send me one? And I'll sign a confidentiality agreement, whatever." And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, it's pretty expensive to ship things from New Zealand. Why don't I just fly out and I'll bring one and we'll look at it together." So like on Tuesday, Lawrence, who's the inventor, shows up in Klamath Falls, Oregon from Auckland, New Zealand with this garage bunny thing. And I'm like, oh man. So I'm like, I'm really hoping this thing isn't a turd. Like, I don't know. It looks cool in the video, but who knows? So we set it up in the office, we stick a bike in it. We start doing some bunny hops and I'm still not quite sold on it. And then I get on it and man, I've done a lot on a bicycle over the years, but I did a couple bunny hops and I couldn't stop. I got absolutely drawn into this thing and addicted to it. It's got a height indicator on the side. And I'm like, dang, I bet I can do a 12 inch bunny hop or 13 or 14. Next thing you know, I'm, maxing the machine out. I'm like, okay, I'm sold. We're doing this. So we wrote a licensing agreement that week. We signed it, I think that weekend or the next week. And then we started fine tuning the product, sent it to our engineer who cleaned up a bunch of stuff. We made some working prototypes and in 3 weeks, we're launching the product. It's going to be for sale on our website. So that's an example of that, impulsiveness or that quick decision stuff or that being nimble, but you got to be careful because that gets you in a hole real quick. Again, I got lucky.
Yeah. And it's kind of funny because meeting Lawrence, same thing, he's in the same boat where he's like, all right, cool. I'll jump on a plane and come over here and just submit it. And yeah, a few days later, and then he drove from Oregon to Idaho to give us one to play around with and check out. And
exactly.
He's such a character. Mission. Yeah. Well, I think that's kind of what it takes is like that passion and that drive. There's no one telling him, hey, you should do this. It's him not being able to sleep and saying, I want to do this. And that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't mistake his passion. That guy is passionate. And man, he can do a mean bunny hop too.
Anyway. Yeah. With all that, all that being said and everything that we've kind of gone over, how are you using the success that you guys have had as a company to help out in the community or kind of give back to biking? I know you've done a lot in your local area of Chiloquin. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, that same joy that I described at that Leadville event and the same joy that I get from seeing someone on a podium or winning a race because of some cornering work or something we did, I get that, from helping kids too. So Hannah, obviously my life partner / fiance, and I decided to do something for our little town of Chiloquin. We live in Chiloquin, Oregon. It's a little tiny town in Southern Oregon, population 752. It's a not real well-off community. The kids don't have much. There's a couple schools and that's it. And so we set out to get bikes for these kids. So we worked with Strider to purchase 30 Strider bikes for the little kids. Then we, on our own through Ninja, we purchased some bikes for the slightly older kids. And then we found out there was a whole fleet of bicycles that the neighboring community had purchased but weren't being used. They were stuck in a warehouse someplace and been there for a couple of years. So we found them and convinced the county that was in charge of these bikes to allow us to use them for Chiloquin. So we ended up through that and through donations and a bunch of help, ended up acquiring almost 100 bicycles. So now we've got bicycles. Now we got to get the kids to ride them. So we, Hannah and I started an after-school bike program for the kindergartners, elementary school kids, middle school, the high school. And a couple times a week, we'd meet the kids and ride. And we did that last year. And man, we didn't have any place to ride. There's no trails in Chiloquin. We had a couple jump ramps set up and some cones and whatever in a grass field. And we essentially dodged the lawn sprinklers for an hour after school every week. And it was okay, but I just kept thinking these kids need more. They need a place to ride. So I went to, Hannah and I went to city council and we proposed to the mayor and the city council that we would like to donate a bike park to the community. We just need a piece of land to put it on. And we'd identified a couple parcels of land that were owned by the city that we thought would work. And our A choice, this beautiful piece of land that covered with trees, backs up to a softball field, a 3-acre parcel that the city allowed us to use to build the bike park. And then we had Jeremiah come out and build the park earlier this year. We did a big grand opening. I don't know how many kids we had there. There were so many we couldn't count. They were all just out shredding on the park. And I drive by that park every day on the way home. And man, it's hard not to tear up when I go by because I see kids out there riding. And I just go by and tell the kids I'm there to pick up trash or whatever. But I'm just so happy to see them hitting the jumps and riding the skinnies and hitting the rollers. It's just absolutely the best. So we've committed to continue to do things to help our little community with providing bikes, after school programs in the bike park. But we want to do more. And we think we've come up with a formula that could work in other cities and communities. And we hope if there are other communities out there that need bikes or need something like this, that maybe they'll reach out to us and we could share how we've done it, what we've done, resources, et cetera. Any opportunity we have to help a kids group, kids organization, we always say yes. If they need ramps for a club, or if they want knee pads or elbow pads, or they want a free class. I mean, it kind of varies according to the location and specifically the one, but we always do everything we can to help them.
That's really cool. Do you think that potentially you could see like a Ninja Scholarship Fund or something of that sort in the future?
Yeah, sure. I would consider that. I think that's smart. We haven't advertised this, but it's pretty common in our community for kids not to have bikes. So we'll bring the bikes out to the bike park, tell the kids who are there and they can ride. But we've had a few families reach out like, hey, our three kids have outgrown their bikes. We're really looking for their bikes. You know, let's find some bikes. We find bikes for them. Like, people will give us bikes and we'll piece together a few and Frankenstein a bike, but we're doing what we can to get bikes. So anything we can do to help, anything we're trying to help.
That's really cool. No, I appreciate you giving back and doing that because I think it's so easy to just hoard whatever success you do have to yourself and not give back. But it seems like you and Hannah both are just really good people that want to help.
Yeah. I mean, the Ninja's, you know, as like I said, a reasonably substantial company now, continuing to grow. But I don't really care about the money. I care about making a difference. You only live once. I'm 50 years old. I'm not going to be around that much longer. Like, I want to know that I did something cool and good. And if the whole thing disappeared and Ninja didn't exist anymore, this is what I'd still be doing. I'd be at the bike park teaching kids how to ride jumps, or I'd be digging new jump lines or whatever it was.
That's cool. No, I appreciate you a lot for everything you do. So I can see that passion and I hope others can see it as well. And I guess I just had one more question for you, more so on the coaching side. But when it comes to like skill development and people wanting to learn how to ride and get better, what do you think is kind of a good pyramid structure for the skills that they should learn first? And then maybe what is one of the skills that's overlooked the most in your opinion?
Yeah, I think those two things are kind of the same. A lot of people, like I did as a kid on my Schwinn Stingray, don't take the time to invest in skills training. The most important skill, or the where I would start, would just be the foundational skills, understanding body position, where you should be on the bike, when, and truly understand it. Like, take time to understand the physics of it, like where you are relative to the center of gravity of the bike and why that's important. I think once you get that, then other things start making sense. Once you've got the foundational work done, probably cornering, tech, and this is one that's overlooked too, is braking. A lot of people don't truly understand their brakes. I think that's one that people can spend a lot more time on.
Yeah, that was going to be my number one.
Yep.
Is braking. Yeah. Yeah. Because I see so many people where they don't understand how to use their brakes. And then when they hit their brakes, it upsets their body position. And so like, if basically your brakes are a button that completely throws your body position off every time, then it's going to be hard to go fast.
Or worse than that, like, and know when to use your brakes. You know, like that was a big thing when I was learning cornering, which was understand, do I go into this hot, hit my brakes in the corner or brake before? Because you hear a lot of stuff, man. It's hard to really know what's right and what isn't.
And I would say beware of any coach that speaks in absolutes, where they say, this is how you always do this, or this is how you always hit that. Because there's so many different ways to navigate something. And I think we did a video this past year where it's like three different ways to hit the same jump. And I think that's the kind of stuff where sometimes I'll see coaches are like, here's the method. It's like, well, there is a preferred method, but sometimes you have to do plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E, whatever, you know.
Yeah, you might know everything about how to hit a jump, but if you come up slow, you better know what to do, especially if it's a gap or whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm with you.
Yeah, totally. And then I guess final question, just out of curiosity, how do you navigate like the insurance thing? And have you ever met people or had coaches that you know of that tried to do coaching clinics without insurance and then had it go sideways on them?
Yeah, I do. I know of two coaches who taught without insurance who had bad injuries occur in their events, and it was bad. There's insurance available. It's expensive. And when we first started Ninja, it wasn't that expensive, but just in the last year, insurance costs have doubled for us. And I've heard the same for a lot of independent coaches. That's why we've offered insurance to our instructors. If you're an active instructor for Ninja and offering private instruction, you can run the instruction through Ninja. We keep just enough to cover the cost of the insurance because we have such a large insurance policy. It's not that expensive for us to add the insurance to cover all of our coaches for their private instruction. So using Ninja is a good way to do that. Looking at what coaches have to pay now for annual insurance, I don't know how it works out for it to be, you know, a cost-effective business for them.
Is it like in the thousands, like thousands of dollars a year type range?
It used to be something like $500 a year, and now I'm hearing it's in excess of $1,000 a year for insurance. But if you're only teaching a couple times, or 6 or 8, 10 times a year, and you're charging whatever, it's hard to be. And the more, obviously, the more clinics you offer, the more expensive insurance is. We've been lucky, let me knock on wood, in however many years, 13 or almost 14 years of teaching, we've not had any serious injuries.
Yep. I think that also speaks a little bit to the way that you design curriculum and you talk to coaches. And, you know, it's like, it's very easy to take someone who you can build trust with a customer or a student pretty easily. And so, like, you can build this trust and they start to believe in what you say. And then you say, all right, you got this, go for it. And then they can just put themselves in a situation that's really bad. So I've seen that happen a lot of times. And I don't know, from your perspective and from mine, like, I'm always kind of pulling people back a little bit. And I'm like, all right, you can do this, which is great, but let's learn how to do it right. And then move on.
Well, Kyle, that's one of my favorite things. I remember teaching drops at a park in New York, and the whole class was ready for the more advanced drop. It wasn't a very big drop, maybe 18 inches or 2 feet, except for this one participant who just wasn't following direction well, had pretty poor proprioception, just wasn't ready for this. And when I asked the class, were you guys all ready for this? Everyone was like, yeah, we're all ready. And I'm like, okay, let's go. And we got down to the rider who I knew wasn't ready. I asked him, I'm like, are you sure? He said, yeah, I'm ready. I'm like, okay, tell me your plan. What are you going to do? And he's like, I don't know. I'm like, okay, let's time out. Let's go back to know to what you do know and see if we can build on that. But yeah, you're right. They just like me with the flaming hula hoop. Sometimes you just think it'll work out.
Yeah. Well, cool. Thank you so much for all your time. I really appreciate this. I know you guys are busy, and thanks for carving out a little bit of time for us. I hope people really enjoyed this and get something from it. And yeah, is there any parting words that you want to say?
No, I'm grateful to you, Kyle. Thank you very much for doing this and having me on. I love sharing this. I hope if anybody, you know, wants any information on how they might be able to help their community with bike programs, after school programs, acquiring bikes, whatever, I'd love to help. Anybody's interested in coaching for Ninja, I can get them set up with the person who gets all that going. But yeah, I think just I hope everyone can just keep having an open mind as to other instructors to learn and to share everything you have. Keeping it to yourself isn't going to do any good. I really believe in just the more you give, the more you're going to get. So yeah, that's it. Just thanks, and I'm good. Thank you.
I hope you guys enjoyed that interview as much as I did. Richard's such a cool guy, and him and the whole team over at Ninja are doing a great job. And I think the fact that they want to give back so much, and you can kind of tell the ethos that underlies the entire company, is a good one. And that's something that I was able to feel the very first time I ever talked to him. You know, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, he reached out and had that abundance mindset right from the get-go. And they've actually used a lot of our videos, our YouTube videos, to help kind of give people homework when they go home and want to watch some stuff to freshen up on skills. So yeah, I just can't say thank you to Richard and the whole team enough. And I really hope you guys enjoyed this one. With that being said, I hope you have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon. Later.